Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to Japan Eats. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama, a food writer and a director of the New York Japanese Culinary Academy, which promotes a deep understanding of Japanese cuisine in America. We are broadcasting live from a studio at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. This show is all about Japanese food and food culture. We see sushi at every deli and supermarket, but what is beyond sushi? We hear dashi ramen izakaya, but what exactly are they? Japanese food is still a mystery for many people, and I will try to demystify it in this program with my cool guests. And my guest today is Ivan Okin, who is the owner of three popular ramen shops, one in Tokyo called Ivan Ramen, and two in New York called Ivan Ramen in Lower East Side, and Ivan Ramen Slab Shop in Hell's Kitchen. He's also the author of Ivan Ramen, Love, Obsession, and Recipes from Tokyo's Most Unlikely Noodle Joint. Hello and welcome to the show, Ivan.
Hi.
I know we can do a show in Japanese because Ivan speaks beautiful Japanese, but we're going to stick with English. So so you're known as not just a great ramen chef, but also an American ramen chef, deeply accepted by Japanese food lovers. And of course, ramen is a national pride of Japan. So it must be really a long way to get there. So could you tell us how your relationship with Japan started?
It's a long story. But you know, I started off at a sushi bar in Long Island when I was 15, and it was my part-time job, my arubaito.
Yeah.
and I quickly became deeply enamored with kind of everything Japanese. You know, the Japanese culture is can be a very difficult one to join. Mm. It's hard to enter. It's Japanese people are they sort of have their little groups, and it's not always easy to get into that.
Not totally open,
yeah.
Like American culture.
But I worked really hard at that restaurant, and I ate anything they gave me. Before you knew it, I was kind of accepted by everybody. Mm. Most of the cooks were like in their late 20s or early 30s, so they were kind of mature, very nice, and I was just a boy. Mm. And I think they really got that I was just this young kid with this job.
Mm. And curious about Japanese culture.
And yes, too. And more and more, because, you know, it was really like walking into Japan, because, they didn't speak English, so, not very much.
Right.
And so they all spoke Japanese together, so I was very intrigued.
Mm. And then you went to college and majored in Japanese.
Yep, at the University of Colorado.
Mm. So, and then after graduation, you went to Japan. And then I think you told me that at the Narita Airport, you felt so familiar that you may have been Japanese in your last life.
Well, you know, I felt, yes, I really... You know, it's funny. I mean, for those of you who are of a certain age, as we get older, it's things seem a little misty. Mm. But I definitely remember this emotion of coming home as the plane landed in Narita, and it was the first time I had ever been there.
Mm.
But I felt really happy to be home.
Mm.
It was a very strange emotion.
Wow.
And I feel that way. I go to Japan a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I'm going home. I don't really feel like I visit anymore. It's when I'm in Japan, it's where I'm from.
And, right.
Yeah.
So, and then what did you do after that arrival moment?
Well, I mean, you know, I've had many chapters in my life.
Mm-hmm.
But this was sort of this chapter was sort of post college, but pre real work. You know, so I graduated with a degree in Japanese, and I sort of just figured, you know what? I mean, I didn't graduate pre law or pre med or business or anything. I was a liberal arts graduate, so I didn't have any idea what I wanted to do with my life, and I just figured a person who graduates with a foreign language degree should go live in the country that they just spent 4 years studying about.
So how long did you stay in, and what did you do?
Well, I did what most people did at that time. I worked at Berlitz, which is a very famous language school. At the time, it was the number one language school in Japan.
Right.
I worked my tail off teaching English and hanging out in Tokyo, and it was sort of a weird time in a way, because I didn't really have a lifestyle of speaking Japanese. You know, I was speaking a lot of English, which was a little disappointing to me. And you know, one thing led to another, and I grew tired of that job, and the bubble burst.
Oh, okay.
Right?
So that was 1982?
1989.
89, okay.
Was right about when things started to get quite shaky.
Right.
With the Japanese economy. And so I just sort of, with a bit of a heavy heart, I decided to go back to the United States, because I didn't really, you know, I was also never a white collar guy, so I didn't really want to go work at an advertising agency or try to work for a company or something. I was never in my brain to be a salaryman ever. I've never been a salaryman.
Right. So that's why you decided to go to CIA, which is also called Harvard of Culinary Education.
It was a really good school, and especially when I went. You know, when I went to culinary school, there still weren't thousands of them. You know, it was still a handful of serious ones. And then there were some, you know, community colleges, and there was some very small schools run on a very small scale. So, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, you know, the CIA was certainly towered over everybody else.
Right.
I always loved food. I think I was a little frightened of becoming a cook. I think I'd thought about it. Also, you know, I graduated in high school in 1981, which at that point, being a chef was not sexy. It was not much different than any other kind of blue collar field.
Right.
I grew up in sort of grew up as a Jewish boy in sort of a, you know, upper middle class area. Mm-hmm. And I actually grew up with very cool parents. And I think, you know, when I ultimately decided that's what I wanted to do, they also were like, yes, that's a great idea. Because they know I love being around food and everything.
Right.
But at the time, it seemed, I think I was a little scared because I knew how hard the work was.
Right. But they ended up working at great restaurants such as Mesa Grill and Lutes in New York.
Yep. No, I think most of my friends and I were very excited about the four-star dining scene and the whole, you know, it was certainly when, if you graduated from CIA, you had an opportunity to work in some of the really good restaurants, and I took advantage of that. Working Lutes was a really transformative experience.
It's really legendary new American restaurant, creative.
Right. Well, Mesa Grill. Lutes was a old style French.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
So, but then you returned to Tokyo in 2003.
Right. Yep. I had many jobs by that point. I'd sort of been with Restaurant Associates for a very long time, which was a good stable job while I raised my child and children, and I just, you know what, I was hankering for Japan, and I had 7 years in the same job, and I was tired of it, and I was ready to move on.
Right.
And I was with my wife and kids in Tokyo on a trip.
Right, because your wife was Japanese.
Yeah, my first wife died many years ago, and she was Japanese, and not really by plan, I ended up marrying another Japanese woman. I actually did not hunt for a Japanese wife. I sort of met her on a total lark blind date in Tokyo with my kid, and she had a kid, and we ended up sort of having this blind date. It wasn't even a blind date, because nobody thought that we would be crazy enough to try to get married when I lived in New York and she lived in Tokyo. But, you know, I was smitten right away, and we met in May, and we were married in August.
Oh my God.
And we've been married for 13 years.
Oh wow.
So,
congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah. So we had married, and in less than a year after being married, we were on a trip to Tokyo. Mm-hmm. She had a great job. She was working, and I was with the children, and it was right around the cherry blossom season. Mm-hmm. And for those of you who have seen that, it's something that's it really draws you in.
Right.
And I was actually in have you ever been to Kunitachi?
Mm-hmm.
So the Kunitachi is, as you know, so people don't know, it's a very famous college town,
right.
A very upscale college town with mm-hmm. a beautiful boulevard. And during cherry blossom season, it's just gorgeous, full cherry blossoms running all the way down for a couple of miles. And I was sitting drinking a Starbucks and watching the cherry blossoms. And I saw my wife a couple hours later and I said, we're moving back to Japan. And just, you know, I just decided that it was now or never. I think I had just turned 40 or I was about to turn 40 and I was ready to, you know, I sold everything I owned and I got rid of everything and we just got on a plane. And
sounds like you have a couple moments to change your life in Japan.
Yeah, it was very cool.
Right. Okay. So, and eventually you chose to cook ramen, right? But, you know, you had skills and experience of Western style, fine dining.
Yeah.
So, but how did you decide to cook ramen?
Well, I mean, you know, it was funny. It was a total lark, you know. I was looking for something to do. My wife was working a really great job, and I was taking care of the kids. But I was getting bored, and we sort of agreed that, you know, I should look for something to do. And I really wasn't up for working for anybody anymore. This was right when sort of the ramen obsession in Tokyo was really picking up steam.
Kind of reevaluating. Ramen used to be like boring, you know, like one in one town, a classic, not fashionable. But there's a revolution.
Yeah, well, so ramen, it's still this way in a lot of parts of Japan. I mean, ramen really, if you ate ramen, you know, 20, 25 years ago, you'd eat in a sort of a Chinese-esque restaurant where they also had fried rice and gyoza. Maybe they had sautéed, you know, a liver with the Chinese chives.
Mm-hmm.
And they would have all these different kind of sautéed dishes and things.
Right.
And they would have ramen.
Right, because originally Japanese ramen came from Chinese ramen.
Right.
And then developed in there.
And there would be lots of, and that's how a lot of ramen shops were. But,
right.
but they were, I mean, there were always, you know, there were always famous shops that just serve ramen.
Mm-hmm.
But it really took on this... You know, I guess how I describe it is that, you know, when I first came back in 2003, there were still a lot of Japanese people that didn't necessarily eat ramen, or maybe they had it once or twice.
Mm.
And then as this revolution started, all of a sudden everybody started eating ramen. Mm. And all of a sudden you couldn't watch a variety show without having a ramen corner. And you couldn't open the newspaper without reading an article about a ramen shop that was very popular. And then it just started capturing, you know, the consciousness of Japan.
Mm-hmm. Right, but, you know, you could have done sushi or something else, right?
No, you know, it's funny. I mean, one of the reasons I chose ramen was I really felt like ramen was like the only thing, the only food stuff in Japan that didn't have any rules.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sushi and the soba and even like udon, especially tempura.
Mm-hmm.
These are all things that have extremely specific ways of being made.
It's like martial arts.
Yeah, it is. It's like it's like ridiculously exact. And I think it's much less forgiving. And I think that, you know, even me, and I mean, I'm just a total white dude, but if I walk into a sushi bar, whether it's here or Tokyo, and I look in, and if I don't like the way the place looks, I walk out.
Mm.
If I don't like the way the guy's holding the knife, I walk out. I mean, I'm just really anal about it. And ramen's different because it's this very secretive thing that maybe a lot of the listeners don't know, but in Japan, people are crazy. I knew a guy who had 7 ramen shops, and they made everything on site, except the sauce, the tare, the thing that flavored the soup.
Mm-hmm.
He made that at home. And then he would drive to each restaurant on like the first of every month and drop off the tare. And then they would have to use that all through the month.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next month he would bring the next batch.
Mm-hmm.
So nobody knew how to make the secret sauce.
Right. So you find out, maybe you could be killed by the guy, right?
Yes. So it's just, so it was sort of, I thought, wow, you know, besides the fact that in, you know, when I was, like I said, when I was in Tokyo at this time, I was eating a ton of ramen.
Mm-hmm.
I should dial back a little bit and say, when I lived in Japan for 10 or 15 years in between Japan trips, ramen was one of the only Japanese things you couldn't eat here. So in New York, you could go to, you know, a restaurant Nippon and have very Japanese, fine, kind of nicely made Japanese food. And you could eat sushi, and you could go and you could go to Sakagura and like have really nice bites and then very nicely, thoughtfully selected sake. But you could not eat ramen. Mm. So when I moved back to Japan in 2003, I was like insane. I was eating ramen all the time. And my wife and I would drive around. We had this thing called the Ramen Navi. Mm-hmm. Do you remember that? It was on the flip phones. Mm-hmm. This is before the smartphones. And you'd open up your flip phone and there would be this thing called the ramen navigation. In Japanese, you call it a navi. And my wife would guide me down these narrow streets to popular ramen shops. And we would drive all over Tokyo eating ramen. Mm-hmm. And so when we were ready to do a business, my wife said to me, well, you know, why don't you open a ramen shop? And, mm-hmm. I was like, you're crazy. I said, I don't know how to make ramen. And she said, you'll figure it out. And I didn't want to work in a ramen shop because, as we're saying, I didn't think anyone was going to really teach me anything in a month or two. And I didn't want to work for 2 years. I needed a real business, you know.
Right. And also you had a great experience as a chef, so you could figure it out.
Yes, and I did figure it out.
Right. Okay. And in 2007, you opened the first ramen shop. And that's Aiwa Ramen at the Roka Koen in Setagaya, Tokyo, which is a very residential area.
Yes.
Like compared to, say, like Ginza or Shinjuku.
Right.
So why did you pick such a residential area, and how did you get socially accepted in local Japanese community?
Well, as far as the finding the ramen shop, I don't know how things have changed now. Back in 2006 or so when I started looking, you know, remember what I was talking about, how ramen shops have no rules and they're really funky. It's because ramen had no respect. Mm. So, you know, most people that make ramen are not cooks. Mm. So you don't have some guy who's trained in fine Japanese dining and then opens a ramen shop. Mm. You know, most of the people that open ramen shops learn from, they get the job, they don't know anything. They learn from the owner, mm-hmm. and then maybe someday they open a ramen shop, but that's their training. Mm-hmm. And so the shops can be very greasy and stinky. So they're not very popular among landlords. So, I mean, I went to dozens and dozens of towns where there was not even one place where you could open a ramen shop. Mm-hmm. And so, and I didn't really want to be in the middle of Tokyo. First of all, the middle of Tokyo was expensive. So if you go to Ebisu or Shibuya or Shinjuku, you know, this is more expensive than mm-hmm. further out. I also wanted to be relatively close to home. Mm-hmm. I just decided, you know, I'd want to be able to be 10, 15 minutes away mm-hmm. at the most. So that's just sort of how I chose mm-hmm. the neighborhood. I, it's a long story, but I got the shop from a completely crazy lady who's thankfully dead now.
Okay.
But I say that with all sincerity. I came in to eat at this crazy woman's shop, and we had a conversation, and I ended up saying, I want to open a ramen shop. And she said, well, I think I want to retire.
Right. Okay. So. But, you know, eventually it sounds like you're part of the community, right?
So. Well, I mean, I've spent 30 years trying to understand Japanese culture, and it comes pretty naturally to me now. And it's like anything. You might meet, you know, I mean, you're a Jap, you grew up in Japan, mm-hmm. yes?
Yes.
So, but you embrace New York, and if you met someone and they suggested that you didn't really understand America, or they talked to you like you were just a sort of a green foreigner, you might be like, well, hold on here, I live here. I lived here for, you know what I mean? So, I mean, right. I feel the same way about Japan. You know, and my wife's Japanese, and right. I had her advising me. So, you know, there's a lot of ways to do things properly in Japan. And so mm-hmm. After we signed the lease, I went to all my neighbors and I gave them all gifts. And I said, hey, you know, I'm going to open this business, and I really hope I don't disturb you in any way. And if I do, please let me know immediately and I'll fix it. And I'm really excited to be part of your area. And I'm a hard worker, and I think I tried really hard to, and I think everybody saw me. I mean, we worked really hard. We broke this whole building down and like built all this stuff, and we painted it ourselves, and we built our own signs, and we did a lot of stuff with everybody kind of watching us while we were working.
So the Daiwa Ramen Tokyo, so how many seats and what's the ambience like? Is it like a local, you know, neighborhood casual place?
Well, I mean, you know, funny thing is when I opened Daiwa Ramen, when I was kind of researching, and I would go to all these shops with my little kids, and I'd go to these shops. You know, this is the truth. I mean, ramen shops used to be like a gangster shop, you know, like down and dirty, like Irish pub or something. They're really like old kind of, you know, Irish pub. Some Irish pubs are beautiful. But, you know, anyway, it was like a pub. Mm-hmm. And I kind of opened the door and they would see me with my kids and they would roll their eyes like, oh crap, they're bringing their kids. They're not going to eat that much. They're, you know, the kids are going to make noise or whatever. And I was always very insulted. I was like, well, you know, my yen's the same as that guy's yen. And, you know, so I kind of vowed to have a nice, bright, welcoming shop when I opened it. And I only mention this because now most ramen shops are now very modern, very hip, very trendy, beautiful lights, you know, very, you know, bright inside, mm-hmm. you know, whereas they used to be kind of sticky, dank, dirty, dark, right. and nasty. Mm-hmm. And so my shop is a little bit on the sort of modern side, mm-hmm. you know, kind of bright and kind of welcoming with colored paint on the wall.
Okay. But I'm sure, you know, the Japanese people are kind of skeptical about, you know, American chef. So how did you make it popular, like nationally popular?
Well, I mean, look, everybody knows that, you know, my part of my hook is that I'm a Jewish guy from Long Island in Tokyo. So, I mean, that certainly is, you know, can't lie about it. I mean, I knew that if I opened a ramen shop and people would be curious. Mm. But I'm also a cook for many years. And I also know that you only have to serve one bad meal to lose a customer forever. So
it sounds like, you know, they don't use a PR company like here in
right.
New York. So word of mouth and eventually...
Word of mouth you know, once the word got out, I started getting on, you know, doing a lot of interviews and being on a lot. I was on a tremendous amount of TV. On New Year's Day, I was on the largest, you know, I don't know, in Japan, you know, Japanese people, New Year's Day is probably the biggest day of the year for Japanese people. They clean the house and get everything ready before. And then on New Year's Day, everybody sits around, they get drunk, and they watch variety television programs with famous actors and comedy skits and all kinds of... I've watched every single year of my life, too, since I moved to Japan.
Right.
And anyway, I was on one of those shows. And so we were closed. You know, most people close their businesses for the first few days. And when we reopened on the 4th, we had, like, you know, 100 people lined up down the road. And it really... It stayed that way for a long time.
Wow.
Yeah.
How cool is that?
It was very cool.
Right. All right. So let's take a short break here. And when we come back, we'll talk about how Ivan makes great ramen. So please stay with us.
Great.
You still paying attention? Are you there? Hello, 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 hello. I'm talking to you. Hi. Hey, this is Jack Inslee. I'm the executive producer here at Heritage Radio Network. I've been here at the station since 2009, and I cannot believe just how much this network has grown over that time. We've been able to grow because of donations from people like you. So if you're enjoying this, if you laughed, if you learned something, contribute anything. $1, $2, $10, $100, $1,000, anything counts. And trust me, we'll appreciate seeing your name come through on the donations. So consider visiting heritageradionetwork.org, click on that little beating heart, the donate button, and show us you care. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoy the rest of the show.
Welcome back. You are listening to Japan Eats, broadcasting live from a studio in Bushwick, Brooklyn. I'm your host, Akiko Katayama. And my guest today is Ivan Okin, who is the owner of three popular ramen shops, one in Tokyo and two in New York, and the author of the great cookbook, Ivan Ramen, Love, Obsession, and Recipes from Tokyo's Most Unlikely Noodle Joint. So, what do you serve at the Ivan Ramen Tokyo?
You know, we've always done, we do the shio, the shoyu, and then we do two mazemen styles.
Mm-hmm.
I fell in love with the mazemen style, you know, almost right after I opened, which really just means less soup.
Okay.
We always try to decide, like, how to explain it so people really get it. Sort of, you know, less soup, more saucy, you know, which sort of sounds terrible, but it is
what it is. Closer to pasta, maybe?
Closer to pasta, it's still very ramen-y because it still has sort of the explosive flavor and it still has the alkaline noodle.
Mm.
One thing I like about mazemen is it sort of preserves the texture of the noodle a little bit more. And I'm a real noodle maven, so I love sort of having people really experience the texture of the noodles.
Because a hot soup can...
Well, and people in America particularly eat more slowly than Japanese, so the noodle softens and the texture kind of changes.
Right. get soggy.
Get soggy.
Right. All right. And you incorporate untraditional flavors such as roasted tomato in ramen.
Yeah.
So what is the idea?
Well, you know, when we opened the shop, I really was racking my brain about toppings and how to bring more umami into my soup without, you know, my ramen is on the much lighter side than, you know, actually right now it's the hottest kind of ramen. My ramen, once again, is really like all the foodies are eating sort of this light style. But, you know, at the end of the day, people like, you know, triple cheeseburgers with bacon.
Right.
So that's what's popular. So the tonkotsu, the pork bone, milky white, sort of really fatty soup is what's most popular. But it's also sort of, you know, like heavy French food with a sauce on it. It's in some ways easier.
Right.
You know, I make a chicken and dashi soup.
Mm-hmm.
So it's much lighter and finer. So I was trying to figure out how to punch that up even more. And believe it or not, you know, tomato has a lot of the natural umami in it.
Mm.
And it's refreshing in a weird way, but also very deep and rich in flavor in another way. And it really, I've gotten, now everybody serves roasted tomatoes in Tokyo.
Right. So
I won't say it was me, but
yeah.
I never saw it before I did it.
Okay. And I found a blog of a huge ramen lover. Obviously, this guy has been to many ramen shops in Tokyo. And
right.
I wanted to share this with you and our listeners. And so this man tasted Yoshio, a salt ramen. And he said, it starts with oceanic and toasty bonito flavor. And after a few more bites and sips, clean, deep chicken flavor kick in. The topping of pork adds another layer of flavor. The soup is balanced, not too salty, yet it has rich and rounded saltiness. Then gradually, effects of the topping of roast tomato step in. The acidity of tomato increases sweetness in salty soup. I'm in heaven.
Nice. So that was in Japanese?
Yeah, in Japanese.
Nice. I got to write that. That was very good. You know, one of the exciting things as a cook for me, just as a cook really, is that, you know, I think so deeply about anything I cook, but the ramen, I spend so much time. You know, I always hated restaurants. You know, there's a lot of pressure on us restaurant owners to put things on our menu.
Right.
And so you end up putting things on the menu that aren't always perfected.
Mm-hmm.
I try very hard to have that not happen. So it's very exciting when a customer sort of puts into words what something tastes like, and I'm like, oh my God, that's exactly what I was thinking when I created that.
Right.
And so really it's very humbling to have someone say that. And we try that very hard. And ramen is a very complex thing because a good ramen really needs to be salty.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a not salty thing, whether it's pork or chicken or beef or whatever you want. I mean, one of the things of ramen is that it's fatty and it's salty, and it's important to have those things in ramen. And yet, if you eat a whole bowl of it, too salty ramen, even if it's not too salty while you're eating it, can make you feel very sick later on. It can make your face feel weird. You know, I'm always, because I'm a fine dining chef, I want my customers to go home feeling great, not feeling, you know, nauseous or feeling, you know, like their heads are bloated with salt.
Right.
So it's hard to get the balance right.
Right. Right. But you know, it sounds like you have very classic items on the menu. So have you ever tried to make totally innovative, like Western flavored ramen?
I've made all kinds of crazy things. Yeah. I mean, In Japanese, you know, I do like a taco rice ramen.
Mm-hmm.
I called it a Mexican ramen. In Japan, taco rice is sort of like a taco on rice, you know, chopped up lettuce and tomato and ground meat and salsa or whatever. But it was my favorite one I've ever made. But I've made bacon lettuce and tomato and at my second shop in Tokyo, I served a triple cheese ramen that was really really popular for a long. It was my most popular dish, and it was great.
By the way, the second shop that was kind of more creative.
Yeah, the second shop was. And it was sort of hit or miss. It was really popular for a while. The neighborhood was tougher than I expected.
Mm.
But, yeah, I mean, when I opened, we didn't even serve any meat soup. We only served dashi.
Oh, wow.
It was all dashi, and I did this cheese maize men that really was outrageous. It was really, really good.
Wow. Okay. And you also make ramen noodles in Japan.
Yes.
Why do that?
Well, you know, I thought a lot about it. First of all, I just, generally speaking, don't like ramen noodles. I mean, just, you know, I would go with my, and this started from years ago, where I would, my wife and I would eat a lot of ramen, and I would go to a lauded shop or whatever, and I would eat it, and I would say, you know, I kept saying to her, I'd say, you know, the soup is so delicious. Why are the noodles so average? And I was kind of vexed about it. I mean, I was like, huh. And it really sort of turned out that, you know, and it's changed a little bit, but back then, you know, 10 years ago, most noodle companies made 5, 10, whatever number of types of noodles they made, and you would have to choose from one of those. And ramen noodles are often, to me, a little too eggy and a little too alkaline and don't have enough fresh flour flavor.
Now, too alkaline means that too chewy?
No, too alkaline means has that sort of baking soda kind of flavor odor, stinky sulfur odor that I don't particularly care for. While I still think alkaline is incredibly important, and if you don't put alkaline in your noodle, you don't have ramen. I mean, I really feel strongly about that. But I also think rather than having that sort of sulfur flavor, I try to replace that with a wheat flavor.
Okay.
Yeah. And so, I mean, that was this, you know, and, you know, my wife who's grew up in Japan, she would say to me, yeah, I've sort of learned that, you know, just because I don't like all the ramen noodles doesn't mean they're not good. I mean, and I didn't grow up in Tokyo, so I didn't grow up eating, you know, those kind of noodles. Right. I think, and I've eaten a lot of, I've worked in Italian restaurants, I've made lots of pasta, I've eaten a lot of udon, I've eaten a lot of soba, I've eaten ramen, I've eaten every kind of noodle. So I think, you know, that's the chef in me. I would eat these bowls of ramen and I would say, huh, you know, if you just did this and this, it would be so much better in my mind. And so I ended up meeting a noodle machine manufacturer in the course of my research for the shop. And, you know, the guy convinced me to get a machine. He just sort of, you know, he ran a little school. It was a 6-day school that I went to. I learned like some of the basic things about ramen, and I love making noodles. You know, I think I've said before, it's like almost like the staff of life. You know, when you take water and flour, and then when you mix it up, you make it into food. It's very humbling to have food made out of something so simple.
Right.
And so I've made a lot of noodles in my life.
Okay.
So it's really fun.
Let me tell you another blogger's statement. So this guy had your salt ramen, and so he said, it's silky. I thought the section was round for its smooth mouthfeel, but it is square. And another person said, the noodle reminds me of Hakata Nagahama ramen, which is the famous style ramen from the south. And they're super thin, yet bouncy, and a rich taste of flour.
I worked really hard on that recipe.
That worked out.
Well, you know, it's the other thing that I... You know, I've been food obsessed since I'm probably before I was 5, and I spend a lot of time thinking about food and how things eat and why they eat the way they eat, and one of the other things. So I would go out with these ramen shops, and I would eat ramen, and I would say, huh, you know, that I didn't love the flavor of some of the noodles, I didn't love the texture of some of those, and one of the other things that I found disappointing, I guess, is that you'd get a bowl. You turn to your friend, you'd say something, you take a sip of beer, and when you went back to your bowl, the noodles would be overcooked. And they would overcook in 2 minutes.
Right.
And I would say, that's too fast. It's got to be, you got to get at least 4 minutes or 5 minutes before they overcook. And like I said, in New York, some people take 20 or 30 minutes to eat a bowl of ramen, which I don't judge, because I think people are trying to learn how to eat ramen and how to eat noodles in general here. But... And the noodles here are different than... I don't get the same flour here, unfortunately.
Okay.
So I prefer my noodles in Tokyo. I haven't been able to get the right flour yet. It's too expensive to get it here. But my noodles in Tokyo don't absorb soup.
Okay, because it's a less...
Because I came up with this... No, because I came up with this really great recipe combining different kinds of flour I use a high gluten, low gluten. I use a bunch of different kinds of.
Right. And do you rye? I use a rye as well.
I use rye here for my regular noodle. In Japan, I use rye for my skeimen noodle. I use rye here because I wasn't satisfied with the flavor of the flour, and I thought it needed more oomph. And by adding a little rye, I got a nice flavor to it. But the flour in Japan is much finer, so that when you, you know, people don't, may not know this, but ramen noodles use very little water compared to, say, a bread. So, you know, to get it to combine, then these machines that we use press the dough together with great force. But the finer the flour gets, the bond of the noodle gets stronger. And you get a chewier noodle, you get more texture.
Right.
And so I understand using Japanese flour better than I understand using American flour. But I'm working on changing that.
Okay, right. So the... Yeah, but just going back to, you know, the, in Japan, ramen is almost like a fast food. It's not a social food, right? So that's why people tend to eat slower here, which I think is more normal.
I think that's a great way to say it. I agree with you. I think, I think that sometimes if you go to Tokyo, you watch people eating pizza, like, just like really? Are you going to like eat like these tiny pizzas? They're like $40 for a 10-inch personal pie, and people, you know, take 2 hours to eat them.
Right.
And it's annoying in a different way.
Right. So, and let's talk about your place in New York. So in 2012, you returned to New York while continuing to operate a shop in Tokyo. Then in November 2013, you opened Ivan Ramen Slab Shop at you know, in Hell's Kitchen, and soon after, your flagship restaurant, Ivan Ramen, in Lower East Side.
Yes.
So why did you decide to open a restaurant in the U.S.? Because, you know, the ramen's popular, the thousands of new Japanese, I know, the ramen shops. And
right.
So what was the reason?
Well, I mean, it was a lot of things. You know, we were coming off that the earthquake. Things weren't great in Japan at that time, for us anyway. We had a little baby and lots of aftershocks, lots of fears of radiation poisoning, lots of all kinds of funky stuff.
Right.
Business was way off for a couple of months, obviously. Mm. People weren't eating out. I just remembering, you know, they also had forced blackouts with almost no notice. So all of a sudden they would, the government office would call you and say, in 20 minutes, we have to turn off your electricity for 6 hours. I don't know if you remember that, but there was rationing of,
right.
of electricity for
right,
a while.
Right.
So that different areas of the city were blacking out at any time of the day with very little warning. So it was really hard to run a normal food service. And and at the same time, you know, I kind of started my relationship with the guys at Lucky Peach and David Chang and Peter Meehan and became friendly with those guys. And they introduced me to my my agent, Kim Witherspoon at Inkwell. And I ended up being able to put together a book deal. So I had a book deal, and all my friends were like, you know, you really should open a ramen shop in New York. It's getting really popular. And then my parents and my sisters found out that I was just thinking about coming back. And then it like the floodgates opened, and you know, and it was funny because, you know, up until that time, in my mind, I was probably never going to live anywhere but Japan for the rest of my life. And, you know, I mean, I was very comfortable with the idea.
Wow.
But, you know, I mean, I'm from here, and I've lived here for a good portion of my life, and I really like it here, and I'm very comfortable here, and a lot of people I love are here, so that's cool. And as I've proven before, I could decide to go somewhere tomorrow and just leave. I never ask anybody's permission except my wife.
Right.
So, you know, so I think our plan eventually is to go back to Japan, you know, it's at some point in the future.
Okay.
And I spent the summer there this past summer.
Because you have to operate the place in Tokyo too.
Yeah, and just being there, it's really good for me. It's you know, I get sad if I'm not there. So creatively, it's important. I get re-energized when I'm there, and I really have this intense connection. You know, and when I'm not there for a while, I start to lose it and not feel so good about it. So I'll be there in 2 weeks, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Okay, so. Obviously, you're very successful here in New York, too. So what is the key to making great ramen?
It's the great success. It's the key to any cooking, you know, attention to detail and having everything in its place and being ready to go. I think having a restaurant is hard, you know. And when I opened Ivan Ramen, I didn't really open a noodle shop. I just opened a restaurant. And, you know, to me, people often try to sort of pigeonhole me, and they talk about, oh, well, you worked in these great restaurants, but now you're just like a noodle guy, or doesn't that make you feel bad, or when did you stumble, or whatever. And it's always funny to me because, you know, I often remind people that there's a lot of fancy restaurants that are horrible, and there's a lot of hot dog stands that are unbelievably wonderful. And, you know, I mean, I remember going, I was in a little town, a little section of Kyoto a couple of years ago, and we went to this mochi place, you know, pounded rice cakes, and there was a line, there was a 30-minute line in the rain, and I was like, oh, I don't really want to do this, but we lined up anyway. All they sold is mochi, three kinds, that's it. But when I got it, I have to tell you, it was one of the best things I've ever eaten in my entire life. And it was just this little, it was a pounded mochi with toasted chestnuts in it. It was in the fall. I mean, I get tears in my eyes thinking about it. It was so good. And so, you know, it's all of these businesses that, you know, you have to pay attention to detail. You know, what drew me to ramen in the first place was this whole Japanese notion of doing one thing really well. And in the United States, you know, people really like to have a lot of choices, and so you end up really getting pulled in this direction of offering so much that you lose a little focus, which is, I mean, things happen that way. But when I opened my shop in Japan, it was so fun to just obsess over one thing and do it the same every day, every day, every day, over and over again until it's perfect. And then once it's perfect, staying with it and just getting into the whole, well, if Jewish guy was say, getting into the gestalt of the ramen, and, you know, and for me, it was, it's something that stayed with me, and I'm still that way. And it's a very exciting, you know, way to think about things.
Right. So the traditional craftsman, whenever I speak to those people, they say it's eventually becoming very spiritual because it's about you, how you think of, you know, how do you deal with your object in front of you?
Yeah, and ramen was cool for me because ramen is sort of rock and roll, which would work for me. You know, I worked in a soba shop for a little while, and I just hated it. It was super regimented, and, you know, the boss was like, no, you have to stand that way. No, Ivan, you have to move your feet half an inch, and you have to stand this way. And, and I was like, I hate this, And
so, right. So what's your plan in the short term and long term?
Well, you know, we have some expansion plans, and hopefully we'll be ready to talk about them soon. But we've been talking with a bunch of different, you know, money people and spaces that are available, and, you know, New York in particular, as some of you might know, is very challenging to open a business here. Real estate and regulations and health codes, all these things that make, you know, what could be really simple, not so simple.
Right.
But I think that we'd like to continue sharing the gospel of ramen. And, I think, you know, we have one little niche. One of the things I love about ramen is that there's so many different kinds so that you don't have to have a pissing match about whose is the best. Because, you know, one guy makes his really light, and the guy makes his really heavy. Another guy likes to put tons of garnish on top. Another guy likes a place that's a really pretty atmosphere. Another guy wants a place that's dark and dingy with loud AC/DC. And you know what, if the people are passionate and they make a good product and it's fun, it works. That's why the ramen culture in Japan is so cool, because, and I like to sort of explain this to people who haven't been to Japan, but Japan is a wonderful place, but it's very regimented, and sometimes you try so hard to fit in that it's tiring. And I think the ramen thing is that really cool, and I call ramen the maverick cuisine of Japan. It just doesn't really follow any structure, and whoever has the best ramen wins.
No rules.
And then it gets, you know, the people come in and they say, you know what, I like that music they play, and the owner was funny, and I loved his ramen, and then they're like regulars, you know.
Right. Okay. So sounds like you have a lot of plans from now. So
I do.
Yeah. So please keep us posted and come back.
I will. And thank you so much for having me. It's always fun to get out to Brooklyn, because I live in the north, so I have to come up with excuses.
Great. All right. So listeners, if you'd like to know more about Ivan's restaurants, please visit ivanramen.com. And if you have any questions or comments, please contact us at heritageradionetwork.org. And by the way, we just launched a beautiful new website, so please visit our page, Japan Eats. And Japan Eats is live at 3 p.m. on Mondays and always available at heritageradionetwork.org, iTunes, and Stitcher podcast as well. So today's show was made possible by Santori, and our engineer is Liz Smith. So I will see you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.
Hey everybody, I'm Nick Latham.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.